I think people are already turning to Romans 13, so perhaps we could all do that. It's on page 152 in the Bibles, Book of Romans and chapter 13. And I must confess that right at the beginning, I would never myself have chosen to preach on this subject. And I'm aware that we've had Easter last week and the joy of celebrating Easter. Our eyes have been on the risen Christ. And on the very personal side of what it means to be a Christian, I'm aware too that there may be some people who've wandered into church tonight, possibly as a result of seeing this church on television last week and seeing the atmosphere of praise. I'm aware there are people who may well have been deeply moved by the film Jesus of Nazareth as it's been on the television over the past 2 weeks, and may even have wandered into this church wanting to know about Christ now and the personal side of following him. And in the light of that, turning to a book in the Bible, which I came across in my history final exams in political philosophy, that rather seems to be a contrast with the personal side of following Jesus. But we must face all the Bible, and we have set out in this church to follow through the book of Romans. And that started very personally. It set out to show how we as individuals could become Christians, have a relationship with Christ, how this utterly transformed us, inside out as it were, through the experience of forgiveness and the Spirit of Christ within us. And the book of Romans has moved on through some difficult theological problems and historical problems, and then come back to a very practical section in Romans chapter 12 about how to be a Christian and live the Christian life out in this world. And it's tackling all sorts of aspects which result from being a Christian. And one of the exciting things about being a Christian is that it does affect every single aspect of our lives. It isn't just something personal, as some people say religion is. It's not something one can keep to oneself. It transforms all our thinking, all our relationships, our total understanding of the universe and of life, our understanding of our whole world. So it's not surprising that we come to a chapter which tackles a problem and a subject which affects every one of us, that of being a Christian and yet living as a member of society, a society which affects everything we do every day. When we go out of this church, we are affected by the rules and the laws and the attitudes of the society we live in. So we can't escape from that as Christians. We've got to face up to it. But not only do we face up to it, we discover that God has some very positive things to say, challenging things to say, about being a Christian in society. So I hope that we won't just find that this is an interesting bit almost of political philosophy, but something which strengthens our vision of God and our faith in God. The first seven verses can really be summed up firstly by verse 1 and then by verse 5. So these are the two verses I want to look at in detail to set the scene. Verse 1, the second part, "For there is no authority except from God. Those that exist have been instituted by God." We live in a world where there is authority. One of the chief ways that this is expressed is in the state, but it's not the only way. For example, there is the authority of the family and of the father in the family. There is a very clear New Testament statement that the father is the head of the family. But that authority is shared by God. And so when we come to the authority of the state, we find that it's also an authority that is shared by God. All authority comes from God. A person in this world has rightful authority only because God, in his love and wisdom, has chosen to share his authority with human beings. He has done it for our sake. Now, the reason that God has chosen to share authority with the state stems right back to the beginning of the Bible when we read about the fall of mankind. We don't know how this world would have worked out if mankind had never strayed away from God. But we do know that once that break had taken place between man and God, God did everything in his power to minimize the effects of that sad choice. He set out to bring the world back to himself through Jesus Christ. But in the meantime, he didn't let the world degenerate into the mess that it could have got into. He did all that he could do to preserve man's dignity, man's enjoyment and pleasure in life, and man's safety. And he did this by setting up the state, by working providentially through history to see that civilizations emerged, that states emerged. And they were to combat and neutralize the effects of the fall of man, particularly two of the instincts that got completely out of hand after the fall. Man's aggressive instinct, on the one hand, given for some right form of self-preservation, but after the fall, becoming simply used by the strong against the weak. So God set up the state to be a check on man's aggressive instinct. And so we read in verse 3 that rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. That is the point of setting up rulers, that they might be a terror to bad conduct, that people who might go around crushing the weak, stealing and robbing, doing just what they liked, would have a check set upon them, upon their aggressive instinct. And that check is the state. Also after the fall, man became greedy. No longer was he satisfied with what God provided for him, but he constantly and continually wanted more. So upon that greediness, God set another check. He set up the state to deal out justice economically, to see that all men had a fair share. So one of the purposes of setting up the state we read about is in verse 6. For the same reason also you pay taxes, for the authorities are ministers of God attending to this very thing. Pay all of them their dues, taxes to whom taxes are due, revenues to whom revenue is due. So the state is there to deal out the good things of life and to make sure everybody has a relatively fair share of all these. So these are the two major purposes of the state which are set clearly before us in this chapter of Romans. The state is there to hold back man's aggressiveness, set up for our safety and protection, and it's there to share out fairly the good things that God has given. I think we might pause at that stage just to consider some of our attitudes to the state on that level. I wonder whether we have a deep sense of gratitude to our own rulers. It's so easy, isn't it, to be swept along with the attitudes of the world around us, which are generally to grumble at those in authority. But how often do we pause to ask ourselves what sort of job would we make of it? And how often do we really turn to God in gratitude that we have a stable government in this country? That our government is a terror to the bad, on the whole. That evil is kept in check. That crime is kept down. These things which we so easily take for granted should be sources of great joy and gratitude to us. That God's word is proving true and that the state in this country is working out as God intended it. And as God planned it. And what about the paying of taxes and the dues and the revenues and the VAT and the this and the that and the other? How often do we join in a general sense that we are being got at by the state? The world around us so easily looks at taxation like that. But as Christians, we should have a far more positive attitude. We should have a sense of rejoicing that we are able to share with others. That our education system, for all its problems and weaknesses and shortfallings, is nevertheless
a very fair system that does give every one of us a chance to contribute to the education of those who are born in this country. Our roads, which we take for granted, and every side of our aspect economy is something which we should be very grateful for and should be aware that God has given us these things, and we should be grateful to Him and grateful to a state that is doing its best to see that we're able to continue sharing the good things of life between us. Gratitude to God and gratitude to the state should be the mark of a Christian, part of our overall gratitude to God for life, so easily replaced by the grumbling of the rest of the world. If these are the purposes of the state, then, and that should in general be our attitude to it, to the state, what should our more particular attitude be? And as I say, I think that is summed up by verse 5. And here we're given two reasons why we, as Christians, should willingly submit ourselves to the state and participate in the state and do what the state demands. The two reasons are, firstly, to avoid God's wrath. That, of course, is why everybody obeys the state. They may not recognize that it is God's wrath that they're seeking to avoid, but they realize that the authorities will catch up with them, and the results of that will be very unpleasant if they continue to do wrong. That, of course, is just how God planned it. He planned that the state should be a check on man's aggression, on man's selfishness, on man's greed. But we as Christians see beyond the fact that we will be punished if we're caught. We see that behind the authority and power of a ruler, behind that policeman who walks down the street or drives around in his panda car, behind that there is the authority of God himself. We see behind our judicial system, behind our laws, not only the wisdom of God, but also the power of God. Therefore, for any one of us as a Christian to go against the state, to break laws, is not only unwise, because we will experience wrath, we will experience punishment, we'll experience the sword, as it's put here, but also we're going against our God. That leads on to the second point, which is we should not only be submitted to the state because of the wrath of God, because of what the consequences will be if we're caught. Everybody submits to the state for that reason, eventually, forcibly or not, unless they happen to get away with it. But we should also submit to the state as Christians for conscience's sake, and that is the second reason that this verse gives for submitting to the state. That is because we are aware that our attitude to the state also is our attitude to God, our attitude to the policeman who is trying to enforce right, says something about our attitude to God. That is the disturbing thing that I find, for example, working with young people who've been brought up with no respect for law, the disturbing thing about attitudes to the police. It's not just that it's antisocial to take little notice of the policeman, but behind that is no sense of authority, no sense of the rightness of right, no sense of the seriousness of wrong. And ultimately, a Christian vision of society restores respect for the authorities, for the magistrates, for the police, and for all in authority in any way, teachers, youth leaders, and so forth. And as many people are worried about the falling standards in our society today, how do we get back to the right sort of respect, which we all recognize is needed in society if it is going to function well and happily? How do we get back to that sort of respect? It's very difficult without a vision of God being the one who is behind authority, and without seeing that in our attitude to teachers, police, magistrates, or anybody in authority really, behind our attitude to them is our attitude to God. And once we take God seriously, we take those he has put in authority seriously. So the Christian vision of society would restore much that is lost in our own society today. Well, these are the principles. Stated like that, they're very clear and very obvious. Society is always set up by God. It's always right to obey our rulers. We as Christians should submit because God in the first place set up the state, and because specifically as Christians we recognize that he's behind it, and in submitting to the state we submit to him. That's neat. But unfortunately there are complications when it comes to working it out in practice. In fact, some people have reacted so strongly against the neatness and simplicity of this chapter in the Bible that they've gone as far as to say that Paul really was so oversimplifying that he was wrong. At this particular time, some people say Paul had found it very convenient to obey the state. Roman justice was a very good thing. Wherever he went, he found he could appeal to it, and that it was on his side, and therefore he wrote a letter saying, support the state. If he had had to write a letter a few years later, when in many areas the state apparently was turning against Christians and imprisoning them and persecuting them, Paul would have said something very different. So we've really got to take this chapter in its historical context and not think we can once and for all get a Christian theory of the state from it. That sort of thing is said in some circles today. And some of the evidence is drawn from the Bible. They will say that if you turn to the book of Revelation, there you will find the state depicted as a beast, a horrific and horrid creature with horns and eyes goggling in all directions, because the beast there represents a force that is persecuting Christians. And in the book of Revelation, because Christians are writing are in a state of persecution, they see the state as something oppressive, something satanic, a very different picture than the firm, clear picture of the state set up by God, which we have in Romans 13. So I must make some attempt to answer those charges if I'm going to take this chapter seriously, which is now what I want to try and do. First of all, the principle that God set up the state runs from the beginning to the end of the Bible. It is never denied. In the Old Testament, even when the Jews were attacked by non-believers, they still believed that God's purposes were working out. They believed that God was in control of all the nations, that Cyrus, who we read about in our Old Testament reading, was in God's control and carrying out God's purposes, even though he wasn't a believer. The state is always working out the purpose of God. Jesus demonstrated very clearly when he was on the earth that he believed that the state was set up by God, that authority came from God. When he stood before Pilate in that dramatic moment, which we considered in this church on Good Friday, Jesus told Pilate very straight and very clearly that the only authority that he had was from God. And even in the book of Revelation, it isn't denied that the principle of the state comes from God. Failures in practice don't undermine principle. We don't believe as Christians that because many marriages break down, marriage is not set up by God. We believe that the principle of marriage is set up by God. So as Christians, we believe that although that there are many failures in states and in government throughout the history of the world, it does not undermine the principle. God set up the principle that mankind needs to be ruled and that he sets up the states and he is ultimately in control. So the principle stands from the beginning to the end of the Bible. Nevertheless, second point, the Bible admits that the state can be satanically influenced, that there are forces behind this world, and that these operate not only in attacking individuals, spiritual fallen forces, but that they operate in attacking the state. We get a dramatic picture of this in the book of Daniel, some of the struggles that are going on in the unseen spiritual world which are affecting the state and the outworking of history, and we get it very strongly in Revelation, hence this picture of the beast, that under the influence of Satan, the state begins to act in a beast-like way. And that indeed, towards the end of time, the nearer it comes to the return of Christ, we have a picture in the book of Revelation of the satanic forces trying to operate more and more powerfully in bringing the state under its sway and under its influence. So the state is open to satanic influence and to corruption. In the third place, even in a healthy state, like I believe we can call our own in this country, we need to remember that the leaders are still fallen men. In fact, the miracle of the state, according to the Bible, is that men have produced such a just and comparatively fair system in so many parts of the world as they have done today. Because when we consider the greed and the selfishness and the self-interest of the human heart and of our own lives and thinking, it is quite amazing that so many comparatively just and good and righteous and positive governments do exist. And that in itself is evidence that all that the Bible claims for the state is true, that in the providence of God, he has got his hand on this world and he is in control, that he is governing and he is guiding. Nevertheless, every single ruler, every single member of parliament in this country is a fallen person and is bound to make fallen decisions and to fall short of perfect justice and goodness. We live with a society that reflects the imperfections of humanity, and we have to face up to that. But it therefore follows, and this is my fourth point, that as Christians, we have a very clear duty to prick the conscience of the state. We are the salt and we are the light of the world. Not only in a general sense, but in a very specific sense when it comes to the state. We should be salt. We should be challenging the state. We should be light. And of course, as we look at the history of this country, one of the wonderful things is that God has done this. He has used the church, he's used individual Christians to challenge society, to challenge slavery, to inspire education, to inspire youth work, to inspire hospitals, and so on and so on. Christians have been the salt and the light working away within society. I think sometimes today we feel that the state has become so complicated and we as individuals are so powerless that we have no possible vision of what we as Christians can do for the state. One of the things that has taken all these clergy and other members of the churches to this conference, NEAC, up at Nottingham, is a conviction that Christ has strong words to speak to our world, to our society today. That's why the title of the conference is Obeying Christ in a Changing World. In every generation, Christians need to be seeing what they have to say to society about the changing world in which they live. And prayerfully and hopefully this conference is looking to come to many clear decisions and come to many new insights about what the church is meant to be saying to our society in this country today, and to come away from that conference with a clearer and stronger voice to challenge the nation. This, of course, means getting involved. It means getting involved where our voice is going to be heard, not only sitting in the pews, but in committees, in parliament maybe, in the media, and so forth. We must be pricking the conscience and challenging the standards of the state. In the fifth place, we must remember as Christians that God is the ultimate judge of states. God has written it into this world that any ruler who constantly and continually oversteps the mark, who goes against what he's set up to do and to be, will find that he is judged. The Napoleons and the Hitlers of this world eventually fall. God's justice does ensure that. What we find difficult to understand is how long these rulers can go on operating without that judgment falling. But that, of course, is consistent with the whole picture of God we have in the Bible, that he is slow to anger and slow to judge. If God acted rapidly in every situation in this world where there was injustice, God would be constantly intervening. And he has covenanted to hold back his judgment as long as possible, so that he can give us a genuine freedom as human beings and as mankind to work out our destiny. Therefore, he holds back his judgment, but only up to a certain point. And then in the end, especially in this matter of the state, God's judgments are seen to be active in the world. And in the Psalms, we find that we're encouraged as Christians to pray for God's justice to work out, to pray for God's judgment to fall. And if we sense that there are regimes in this world which are desperately unjust and going against all that they were set up to be, we have a right laid clearly down in the Bible to pray with all our hearts that God, the judge of all the nations, will stretch out his hand and bring his judgment to bear upon those rulers. And my last point, which leads on to the most complicated issues altogether of church and state, is this. That when it comes to a genuine conflict between God and the state, we have a principle laid down in Acts chapter 5, verse 29, that we must obey God rather than men. This is what the disciples said when they were hauled up before state authorities. As Christians, they believed that it was right to preach. The state said, "Don't preach." They said, "I'm sorry. We must obey God rather than men." So on any clear issue of conscience, when the state forbids something that God commands, or when the state commands something that God forbids, then in that situation, the principle must come into operation: we must obey God rather than men. And again, we must give thanks to God that in this country, I think it is hard to really find issues where there is a conflict between our obedience to God and our obedience to the state. But sadly, we know, and we've already heard about it from Jenny tonight, about the situation in Nepal and in many parts of the world, Christians are caught just in this conflict, that obedience to the state and obedience to God are at loggerheads. It's very difficult for us to sit in our pews, or for me to stand in this pulpit and tell Christians in that situation what to do. And I can't honestly bring myself to do that. This is one of the issues that we must struggle through and think through together. Some Christians would take the line that because the state is set up by God, because God is the ultimate judge, because we are told clearly to submit to the state, then all we can do is to pray, to speak clearly, to prick the conscience of the state, maybe even go as far as passive disobedience, and then leave the issue to God. And in many ways, this is the strongest and clearest line that I can find as I read my Bible. Other Christians, however, perhaps especially those who are in the situation and pushed to this point, say, if it is right for the sake of righteousness ever to fight a just war, isn't it therefore right for the sake of righteousness to rebel against an unjust state? And that is a question which Christians are still debating, and perhaps will debate until the end of time. But it's one that we must face, and one we must recognize that there are not easy answers to, and one which must drive us constantly to prayer for our brothers and sisters who are in that sort of situation. Having ended on that point, perhaps it might be good, sensing the conflict which some of our brothers and sisters are in other parts of the world, just as we sit in quiet and pray, to pray specifically for those in such a conflict. We come in gratitude and praise to you, our Father, for our own government, for the freedom we have as Christians, for even the support we have as Christians by our society. We come in pain and concern for our brothers and sisters who, just because they obey you, are in conflict with the state authorities. Have mercy on them. Turn the hearts of rulers in this world to accept yourself. Give wisdom to our brothers and sisters who are undecided as to how to respond to the state in which they live. For any in this church who are from such countries, we lift them to you. And we lift Nepal to you. And those Christians that Jenny has spoken about tonight. Lord of the state, turn the hearts of those who rule to accept your people. In Christ's name, amen.